Hello all, thank you. I was not here at the beginning of the session and I apologize for missing a couple of the presenters because being with the health law section, I really love to hear what the other presenters are doing and bring such expertise to the field. And the unfortunate part was I'm running for an executive board position in APHA and they scheduled the meeting for the candidates to be at the same exact time as the meeting that we are to present today. I see that one of my co-investigators is here in the room. Cho-Cho Lin, Dr. Lin is here. Actually, Cho-Cho spearheaded this component of this research project, so she could have probably just as readily stood in to do this for me. My name is Pat Sweeney. I'm from the University of Pittsburgh, Graduate School of Public Health, and within the last 6 months, I also took on another hat. I'm now a local health department director in Mahoning County, Ohio. It is my hometown. After 24 years, my predecessor retired, and I am having a ball. So just wanted to share that with you. The other co-investigators on this, the other principal investigator is Rick Zimmerman, also from the University of Pittsburgh. No relationships to disclose. This project is funded by the Public Health Law Research Center, or research program that is located at Temple University and is a program of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. Why did we do this? The problem. Why did we start to study? Why did we look at immunization, healthcare worker immunization? Well, obviously, vaccination, we know historically, is one of the 10 great achievements of public health in the last century. You know that it's the most effective preventive measure against communicable disease. Throughout history, it's also been the most effective agent to combat influenza. I mean, there have been years where it's been more or less effective depending on the circulating strain and the actual content of the vaccine, but it still remains the most effective mechanism to combat influenza. And we know that within institutions, vaccination of people who can transmit the disease is the best preventive effective measure for reducing impact of influenza on institutionalized patients. Most often, the institutionalized individual is the least effective person to immunize. It is the individual who can carry it to them, the healthy person who has an immune response from the vaccine that will protect the individual that's institutionalized. Yet, over time, healthcare workers, it's kind of embarrassing. No, we have an influenza campaign in my health department. We didn't get 100%. We did not get 100%, despite my, rankle and holding up signs and doing everything I possibly could. It's not mandated yet. And I don't know that we'll be able to get to that with being a local health department, a governmental entity. The Healthy People 2020 target project suggests or requires or is hoping for a 90% immunization rate among healthcare workers. But as demonstrated by NHS and the Behavioral Risk Factor Survey and other internet panels and surveys, we are only up to 64% in the year 2010-2011. So the research questions that we posed in the project that is funded by RWJ is, so there's been a recent movement since 2006 to impose state laws on requiring hospital workers or healthcare professionals to be immunized for influenza. What effect is that law having on actual influenza immunization rates among healthcare workers? And what is it, if it's not state law, is it institutional policy? There's been a groundswell of institutional policy that's starting to put mechanisms in place that either require immunization or require affirmative declination or require education. Are those policies having any impact on healthcare worker influenza immunization rates? And if they are having either the state law or the policy having impact, what components of those laws are actually having the impact? Just having it or not having it was not really sufficient enough to answer the real question, what actually works, what actually makes a difference in healthcare worker immunization. So to do that, this is the theoretical framework of our study. There's an intervention. The intervention piece is the law, and how it's implemented is the legal practice. What change in the environment were we looking for? We wanted institutional norms and professional values and standards to change, and we wanted to have that exemplified in behavior, management practice, standard setting, so that we would have these pieces in place to change environment, change behavior, and then improve population health to reduce the rates of, absenteeism. Reduce rates of healthcare worker absenteeism and reduce rates of hospital-acquired infection, all part of Joint Commission's certain push and a global push to decrease hospital-acquired infections or healthcare-associated infections. So what were our methods? We started out by doing legal research to identify what states had laws and regulations regarding healthcare worker influenza immunization. And then we took those statutes and regulations and mapped them, coded them to understand what the content was of the actual text of those laws. Then we conducted a survey, and really, I'm going through all of the steps of the whole project, but I'm only reporting this part of today is a small subset of the beginning work. We have done additional work, but when this abstract went in, it was on the beginning work, so that's what we'll be talking about today. We conducted a survey of 1,000 different hospital infection control professionals to identify whether they had policies in place and how progressive those policies were, and we did then a study to map those policies and code them similarly to the laws so that we could compare the laws and the institutional policies. And then Dr. Zimmerman and Dr. Jo Lin and Dr. Raymond did their magic with hierarchical linear modeling. And for me to pretend that I can talk about hierarchical linear modeling would be an untruth. So if there are questions about the actual methodology of the modeling, I hope that Jo will be able to answer some of those questions. But it is taking the process and stratifying your I'm not sure. We'll get there. So here's what I'm talking about today. Between mapping the code of the content of the state laws and surveying the research institutions or surveying the hospital institutions, we conduct an analysis of the modeling of the state laws to understand what impact did state law have on healthcare worker influenza immunization rates. To do that, Jo received access to the NIH data set at the National Research Data Center, the National Center for Health Statistics, and was able to stratify state-level information based on demographics and occupation as a healthcare worker. We also then used, we did the legal research and identified states that had healthcare worker immunization, influenza immunization laws. And these are the listing of the states that did have laws. The facility type, long-term care, assisted living, all was all healthcare centers, all healthcare providers. You can see the status was they either had to offer it and educate, shall provide, shall offer and educate. That's what the status means. Recommend means the statute actually said recommend, but then everywhere else, as it was discussed, it was a shall. So it was more than just recommend. But then the opt-out was what is really critical in each of these legal statements. If it says with reason and refusal, what that means is they were given opportunities with reason, would be medical contraindications, philosophical or religious. With refusal, it just said a statement of they can refuse without any rationale. So states that also required, that, like I would give you an example, Arkansas, only long-term care facilities are regulated, the healthcare workers working in long-term care. They shall be immunized, but they can opt out for medical reasons, medical contraindications, philosophical or religious, but they also have to have documentation of whether or not they accepted or refused. As opposed to California, all healthcare facilities and all healthcare providers are to be offered education about the benefits and the negatives of not receiving an influenza vaccination. They have to be educated as to that benefit or detriment to the patient. Then they can also opt out with just a positive affirmative declination. So they have to actually sign that they have refused. So these are the different policies that were available. We located in the states. And there were 22 states that actually have promulgated laws addressing healthcare worker influenza immunization. Only 6 of those actually address all healthcare providers and specifically hospitals. Virginia simply stated they had to develop policies for infection control and nothing further. Texas, long-term care, they have to offer, but there was nothing written about opting out or not opting out. So it was Okay. So what were the problems? We had to take an analytical approach because of the kind of data that was available to us. NIHIS data we had to combine between 2000 and 2006 because healthcare worker influenza rates were too small to have a significant sample to be able to actually pull it out year by year. And when you're talking about laws, that's critical. Seeing how laws change and how behavior changes over time was critical. And that is truly a limitation of the study at this point. In addition, because the state data it was given as healthcare workers, and the data repository is so concerned about being able to have identifiers, they were very, we had to cluster states that had similar kinds of laws. So if there were a number of states that had no law, those could be clustered in terms of the number of bodies and the sample size. So again, a little bit difficult, but from the standpoint of actually having law or not having law, and being a healthcare worker and not being a healthcare worker, we at least were able to get enough information about healthcare workers and in populations that had laws and didn't have laws to at least take this part of the study forward. And what we found was that states with laws, we had to cluster Maine and New Hampshire, Oklahoma and Tennessee, and then California and D.C., obviously not a state, but for the purpose of this study, those jurisdictions had significant enough reporting into NIHS that we didn't have to cluster those. So those were the states with laws that were studied, and these were the states without laws that needed to be clustered, Arizona, New Mexico, Nevada, and you can see that large Kentucky, West Virginia, North Dakota, South Dakota, Idaho, that was a large group that had to be clustered for that purpose. But again, those were states without laws regulating healthcare workers, so it still was valuable. To examine the relationships between the state laws and the healthcare worker rates, that's when Rick and company at the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine did their hierarchical linear modeling. And they used three variables: vaccination status, yes or no, race, white or non-white. And the reason that was used is because as they were doing an initial study, obviously the data for the population shows that there is a disparity between influenza immunization uptake between white and non-white population. It also plays out to be the same, not exactly the same ratio or the percentage, but that trend carries over into the non-white white healthcare worker population. So we use that as a variable because we were seeing some of that data available to us. And also, as I said before, state law, yes or no, did the state law exist? Sample size, Churchill was able to weight, and we learned, you know, average age and average weighted mean and the percentage of female and the influenza rates between total white and non-white and the p-value of those studies. You could see. What we actually, the results of this, or the statistical significance, there was actually a significant difference in between state variance and immunization rates. So state, even though they had state laws, there was variance in between states with laws and their influenza immunization rates. There was also a relationship of race to healthcare worker immunization influenza rates that was confirmed. What we had seen before in the literature was confirmed by this study. The states that had laws in this study were not at this point, I have to interject, at this point, were not associated with having higher healthcare worker immunization rates in general. So just because the state had a law, you did not see higher healthcare worker rates, immunization rates. However, you did. There was a small significance between white and non-white healthcare worker immunization rates in states with laws. To the extent that can be extrapolated, there may be some influence on non-white healthcare worker immunization rates in states that have laws. That's what has been found to this point. No effect on overall healthcare worker influenza rates, and at this point, we're surmising why that may be. We will, as I say, get further through this study, and the next time you hear this discussion, we'll have more answers for you. But the kinds of exemptions that are out there, there are a plethora of exemptions, and just a mere refusal, what's the value of a law? Types of healthcare workers that the law addresses. Not all laws were comprehensive in terms of all direct care, volunteers, different levels of practitioners. Some were very specific to, you know, certain healthcare workers in a long-term care facility. Reporting requirements, some states required a hierarchy of reporting up the chain, some just within their accrediting bodies, others to their state health department. What kind of repercussions were put in place? Yep, I'm getting the 1 minute. Okay. Obviously, date of implementation and combining data over the years really does make that difficult. We are reopening our IRB. We're asking the IRB if we can go back and re-examine at the end of this year so we can have more up-to-date data and see now that we're 6 years down the road or two more years down into this research project that we might be able to do that. The impact of institutional policy on healthcare worker rates is what we're looking at now. We've, as I said, surveyed 1,000 infection control professionals regarding their hospital policy. The policies have been coded, and now we're working on the hierarchical linear modeling of those particular policies and looking at mandate, yes or no, enforcement strategies, because that is a huge difference in what you see in the policies versus the laws. Policies are very specific. Some of them are very specific about enforcement, mask, reassignment, et cetera. And also economic penalties. Are there any, you know, work restrictions, reassignments, or, and that's it. I'm good. Right to the minute. Thank you very much.
Questions for our panelists?
We did not. We surveyed the institutions. It was a 34-item survey. They had the opportunity to return their survey to us, or their policy to us as well, or to answer the questions that were in the survey. So some did and some didn't give us the policies, but they all answered what was on the question. And we didn't say, was this your declination policy today? It was, did you have a declination, and was it affirmative declination? That kind of thing. Although, good question, but I think that many of them have to document the education, and the education tells them what they learned about the risks.
Good. Jonathan, I was just wondering if you had any thoughts about the kind of criticism of the passing laws and suggestions that came out of the Global Commission on HIV and the law reports this year.
So I assume that I'm trying to remember now. So I don't know, that's something that probably...
Well, I guess it's, there's a big core of sex workers who really hate these laws, despite the fact that they're supposed to be protected.
So it's interesting in the sex trafficking context. Australia has an interesting experience. In many parts of Australia, of course, sex work is not illegal. Interestingly enough, as it turns out, they still have an illegal brothel black market, which often operates across the street or around the corner. And that doesn't fully explain that. But it led to some interesting cases, so I think it merits some consideration. Politically, I don't know what happened here, but I think there were two interesting cases in Australia. One is a man was going around beating up women in brothels, and a commercial sex worker felt comfortable enough calling the police saying, this is what I do. I think I saw the guy come through our place. And that would never happen in the U.S., I think, or in markets where it's illegal. And the flip side happened. A customer, after going into a brothel, came out and called the police and said, some of the girls there, I'm worried about. And they don't look like they're necessarily there by choice. And that led to a positive outcome in raiding the brothel. So I think that those... at least prompt a question of, is there an opportunity, are there other opportunities that we're not getting from, and unintended consequences of criminalizing. I think it's a political reality. Two things. One, here in the U.S., I don't think it would happen politically. Two, there's such pressure politically that the U.S. applies elsewhere that tied to funding, even post-Bush administration, that I think makes that challenging.
Home. And I was wondering if in your research on the 50 state surveys, are there any findings related to other types of bullying attributes that similar policies and legal actions could be taken?
Yeah, I mean, so I was the one who actually did the 50 state survey, so I'm sure Christina, who would be happy to talk to you and you want to be and have her contact information. But we did identify a couple of areas where a lot of what I suggested needs to happen with the change in bullying laws would apply in other categories of bullying laws. So I imagine that weight-based bullying as well probably falls within the same category. So I can't answer you definitively, but I know during the course of preparation of that 50-state survey that the law student and Christina were working on it, we did identify potential areas of other research for us as a result of that.
Great.
So I know you talked about you're now expanding into the institutional policies. So with state law or without, a hospital institution can make a mandate for their healthcare workers,
correct?
And then, so you're going to do a study?
We have that. I mean, we have collected, we had 1,000 surveys that went out. How many? 234? How many came back? Our survey return rate. Half? Okay. I thought we were a little bit lower than that. Right before our survey, the CDC had conducted a survey of American Hospital Association. We had to work with them to not resurvey the same hospitals. It was really a challenge, and I think that some of our lower rate may be related to that. But we have surveyed all of the 1,000 hospitals, and we do have results back on those about their policies, the extent of their policies, the enforcement of their policies, the content of their policies, how long the policy's been in effect, their influenza immunization rates in the last 2 years.
But it seems like an institutional policy would
go for that. Yeah, absolutely. We started with state law because there had been so much discussion about state laws, and there are a lot of laws on the books for long-term care, just not so much for
all institutions.
Well, this time we are at the formal end of our session. I'm sure that some of our speakers would, if they have a few minutes, could stick around for additional questions. Please join me in thanking our speakers.